We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
No, I didn't. I'm not in love with you. I meant to have a thing printed out for them, but that's illusion.
My name is Jim Diamond. I'm here on behalf of the University of Waterloo. And we're proud to be a co-sponsor of this event. And also, I'd like to thank other benefactors and donors and sponsors, Meadowland Entertainment Center, First Service Corporation, All Good Casters Limited, H&R Developments, Runnymede Development Corporation, Global Upholstery, and UCAN Fastening Products, who made this event possible. Before I introduce the next speaker, I have the irresistible temptation to say something myself. When I was reading the Parsha today and waiting for that great moment of liberation, as I do every year, there was a moment of disappointment, and that is that the crowning achievement, the crowning event of liberation for the Yetziat Mitzrayim, is a colossal cash grab. So it's a kind of a letdown, an anticlimax. You have the Achrei Chen Yetzu B'Chush Gadol. That at the end of it all, after everything happens, after all the makot, the Jews, the Israelites, go and simply take maybe what they've earned, their back wages, but it seems to be kind of a disappointment, and really an anticlimax to the whole thing. But the rabbis set an ethical bar based on the pasuk here that is really quite high and transformed this anticlimax into quite a remarkable event. And that is, the pasuk says that what they will do at the end of all this is that each Israelite will go, v'yishalu ish me'et re'eu v'yisha me'et re'uta. That what they will do is they'll each go and they'll ask from their re'im, their friends, for clay kesef, clay zah, for all the gold and silver. And the Midrash asks, what are you talking about? These people are our friends? I mean, they just spent hundreds of years in servitude. And so they say, yes, what happened at the end of the day was that the Achrei Chen Yetzu B'Chush Gadol was a result of a resolution of this conflict, that is a moral and ethical resolution, not simply the victims simply walking away being liberated, taking what they can, but yet that it can't be left at that. It can't be left hanging at that. There has to be an ethical dimension to this whole conflict, and that is when each one went to ask, they asked from their way in, from their friends. And that's what the rechush is. The rechush is that in every, I think that's what it teaches us, but it's quite a high ethical standard. But that is, in every conflict, in every situation where you have someone who's been exploited, and you have someone who's done the exploiting, if that situation gets resolved at the end of the day, it can only be resolved when there's an ethical dimension, when each party sees each other as a human being. And that's what happens here at the end. The rechush is simply not a cash grab in the rabbi's eyes, but there's an ethical moment, and that ethical moment is the crowning moment of the liberation. So without further ado, I will introduce our next speaker, Rabbi David Lapin, who is the president of Strategic Business Ethics, Inc., based in Los Angeles. He's also the founder of the South African Institute of Business Ethics, and an author of articles and a code of ethics. I will now introduce him with the interesting topic of the corporate world combining ethics and business strategy. Thank you, Professor Diamond, and Shavuot Tov and Good Vuch, Rabbi Kelman, Rabbi Meir, Dr. Schwartz, and ladies and gentlemen. I initially thought it was very courageous of Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Schwartz to arrange a talk on business ethics on a wintry Motzei Shabbos. I couldn't imagine who would come. But now I've gotten used to that. I'm now full of admiration for the very lovely crowd that we've got here this evening, giving of their time on an evening such as this to hear and learn more about this topic. A topic that is important, a topic that is broad, a topic that has many different facets to it. I'll never forget a time when I brought a donation from somebody who had given it to me to one of the Brisker Rosh Yeshivas in Yerushalayim. And he took the check, which was for quite a substantial amount, and he kind of held it at a distance between his two fingers. You know, I'm used to people, when you offer them a donation, it gets into their pocket rather quickly. If anything, to writing out the receipt takes a little longer, but not the accepting of the money. In this case, he held it at a distance, and he held it at his two fingers, and he said, "Do you know the person who gave this to you?" I thought, this is interesting, I'm now being interrogated. And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Do you know their business?" I said, "I know something about their business." He said, "Are you sure the money is kosher?" I said, "How can I be sure the money is kosher?" He said, "Why don't you give it to another yeshiva? I will not accept it unless I know the person, or the person giving it to me knows the person and can vouch for its kashrus. Money needs a hechsher just as anything else needs a hechsher. Who can convince me that this is kosher? How can I build a Torah institution on money that might not be kosher?" That's business ethics. Turning money down is business ethics. Talking about what we can do and what we can't do, and we carry on with business as usual. This is a different kind of level of expectation, understanding that the laws of kashrus go far beyond the food that we eat. And as important as the laws of kashrus are, and they're critically important to who we are as a nation and to a central part of our Torah observance, it's sometimes troubling that the level of, I don't think it's wrong to call it obsession, that we have with food and the kashrus of food is not replicated in all areas of Jewish law. And that's why it's so admirable that the people who are sharing the panel with me this evening and the people who organized this evening have such an interest in this particular area. Rabbi Meir spoke about whistleblowing, Lashon Hara. The Economist last week had a couple of articles wondering why whistleblowers are usually treated so badly. They often lose their jobs. They certainly aren't heroes. Not only do they lose their jobs, but very often they can't get re-employment. One would think management might want to hire a whistleblower. If he saved the previous company, or she saved the previous company, perhaps they might be able to save one's own company too, but that isn't the case. Whistleblowers are often avoided. And even now, with the Enron case, there's a lot of talk about Sharon Watkins, who did try to blow the whistle, and who she is and what she is. Very interesting discussions around them. And we have to be a little bit careful, because in the area of business ethics, and just touched on a little earlier, that one has to broaden the subject, because there is the danger of Jewish business ethicists becoming self-righteous moralists. And there's only one thing worse than a business thief, and that's a self-righteous moralist. At least the business thief is colorful, he's fun to deal with. The self-righteous moralist is a pain. And we see that in a number of different areas. We see it in yeshiva. Who's more popular, the Rosh Yeshiva or the Mashgiach? Who do the bright boys like being around? Who would you rather spend a Motzei Shabbos with? The Mashgiach or the Rosh Yeshiva? The Mashgiach is always the guy who says, you shouldn't be doing this and you shouldn't be doing that and stop doing this. And the Rosh Yeshiva is the guy who's celebrating the innovativeness and the brilliance of the Torah and is alive and full of positive thoughts. And he's always more popular. I remember one of the most important moments in my life was a very private conversation that I had with Rabbi Yosheva Soloveitchik of New York and Boston. And I was trying to break through to him. I was trying to get him to open up a little bit, and anybody who knew how hard that is. Certainly as a stranger, I'd never met him before. And I got him to tell me something, and I thought this is my opportunity. And I said to him, Do you have disciples who can really understand what you've just said? And his eyes lit up. And he said, my disciples? Of course they can't understand. I used to have disciples who could understand that. He said, I'll tell you what my disciples are like. It's not, but a Lashon Hara is coming out. Now we're getting some. He said, I'll tell you about this. I'm giving a shiur the other day, and I'm building it up, and I'm building it, and the questions are coming, and layer upon layer. And I'm getting to the most exciting point. It's going to be the crescendo of the entire shiur. And I've built up a level of excitement. And as I'm about to put the final question, a boy raises his hand. And I'm so full of excitement. Is it possible that one of my students has actually grasped what the question is and he can articulate it? And I say, yes, what do you want to say? And he says, Rabbi, you're holding a glass of water. You're about to say a brocha. You're holding it in your left hand. You're supposed to hold it in your right hand. He says, those are my Talmidim. Of course they can't understand. And we laughed about that a little bit, and that opened the conversation. And then I thought to myself, why didn't he say thank you to the boy? Why doesn't he say, you see what wonderful Talmidim? Look how righteous my students are. I'm busy teaching Gemara, and he's worried about saving me, possibly saying the bracha incorrectly, holding the glass in the wrong hand. Why didn't Rabbi Soloveitchik say, what a wonderful student I've got? Nobody likes the whistleblowers. Nobody likes the moralists. They're narrow, they're restrictive, they're inhibitors of business, not facilitators of business. And that's one of the big issues in Jewish business ethics. Is our role to be only an inhibitor? There is an aspect of inhibition, of course. We want to inhibit wrongful practice at all levels. But can we go far beyond that? Should we go far beyond that? Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk wrote a sefer, he wrote a very important work called the Meshech Chochma. This was a book on the Chumash. Brilliant. And his father said to him, Rav Meir Simcha, your sefer is brilliant, but don't publish it. And he said, why? He said, because you'll always be known as the Chumash interpreter. Publish something on Gemara or Rambam first, and then you can publish that one. So he wrote the Osamath, which is reputed not to be as great a work as the Meshech Chochma, and then he produced the Meshech Chochma later on, and he's known today as the Osamath. Nobody knows him as the Meshech Chochma, he's known as the Osamath. When a Rosh Yeshiva, when the facilitator, when the enabler, when the dynamic expansionist tells a boy or a yeshiva, you shouldn't, or a yeshiva, an entire institution, you shouldn't be doing this, it rings a very different bell from when the Mashgiach tells you, you shouldn't be doing this. When a business ethicist says, we mustn't talk Lashon Hara, we mustn't do this, we mustn't do that, it's of academic interest. And sometimes it stimulates some very interesting discussion. But it's important that we play a role far beyond that in the way we handle our business ethics. And I think that we're seeing quite a lot of that thinking coming out of the institute and the Jewish Institute of Technology. Our debate doesn't need to be so much about the wrongs and rights and the do's and don'ts. I've done research over 21 cultures around the world, and I can prove that all cultures, all levels of education, have a pretty good knowledge of right and wrong. Don't forget, it was Adam who ate from the tree of knowledge of right and wrong. And he taught it to his children, and his children to their children. People have an innate knowledge of what's right and wrong. Most people are brought up by pretty decent parents. I've even interviewed crooks in jail, and they know exactly what's right and wrong, and they would not want to see their children doing wrong. The exception to that are gang members, people of particular groups who have developed a different kind of a value system. But leaving that aside, the ordinary person from any culture knows very well what's right and wrong. That's not really the issue. The issue is, can we get people to do what's right even when the cost is high? What do you think, the guys at Enron thought that what they did was right? Do you think the guys at Enron now think that what they did was right? Of course not. You know, they don't need self-righteous moralists telling them that what they did was wrong. The question is, what do you do to develop a culture in a business where even when the cost is high, the character is such that people are willing to do that which is right? I began, a few different things stimulated my interest in the field, but one of them was reading a very short and memorable passage in Tolstoy's War and Peace, where he's withdrawing and pulling his troops out of Moscow, and his people, General Kutuzov's people, are saying to him, but this is the end of it. We're finished there. If we're pulling out of the city, this is the end of it. And he says, no, we're going to win this war. He says, because they're fighting on foreign territory and they don't know why they're really fighting. The soldier, the French soldier who's fighting us, doesn't really know why he is. We're defending our motherland. Every one of us knows why we're fighting. And we're going to win. And I realized then that we can achieve amazing things, whether in war or in business or in the professions or in personal life, if we can access the heroic in man. And that was really the question that intrigued me. Can business access the heroic in man? Do people only become heroes when they're out on battles, when they're out fighting in the battlefield for what they believe is right? Do people only become heroes when they're working in the emergency rooms of hospitals saving lives? Or is it possible for people to be heroes in their day-to-day work lives too? And the answer really lies in General Kutuzov's comment. We believe in what we're doing. When people believe in what they're doing, they do amazing things. The very best comes out of them. When people doubt the morality of what they're doing, is the time when they become far less great in stature and far less heroic in action. What we need to do is to test the morality of business. Is business inherently a divine activity, or is it a secular activity? The Christian church became very divided on that. And it's interesting that Catholic countries are poorer than Protestant countries. And there's a reason for that. Because every person involved in work who is devoutly Catholic, deep down, questions the morality of what he's doing. Every Protestant who's involved in work believes in what he's doing. And there's a completely different aspect of output and productivity when you believe that what you're doing is right, when you believe that what you're doing is divine. So what is right? Are the Catholics right or the Protestants right? Who created business? When did business start? God created business. He could easily have made the world in such a way that you didn't need to do business. He created the conditions for business from the very beginning. Because if you create people who have insatiable desires and needs. And we're told in Tanakh, oh, have kesef lo yisbak kesef. If a person loves money, he'll never have enough. One can never be satiated in one's desire for that, in one's satisfaction of that which one desires. God builds us with insatiable ambition, and that's a part of who we are, and He creates a world of limited resource. And He instructs us, pruruvu, population increase, resource remains limited, and desires and needs are insatiable. Well, that's a condition either for war or for trade. You're either going to fight over resources, or you're going to trade over resources. So God forces man into business and says, that's the way I want you to operate. I want you to trade with one another. I want you to exchange with one another. I want you to deal with one another. And so my first suggestion is that business is divine. It's a creation of God. It's not a creation of man. It's not a concession. Since we have to earn a living, we might as well do business. No, we're meant to do business. Business is part of our required activities. The second interesting thing is the laws of interest are so fascinating. Firstly, if it's so bad to charge interest, why are we allowed to charge non-Jews interest? Why are we allowed to borrow from non-Jews with interest? And secondly, the positioning of the laws of interest are very interesting. They are found in the law in the section of Yoredeya. They are not found in the section of Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat is that part of the Shulchan Aruch that deals with business and business law. Yoredeya deals with kashrus primarily. What's kosher and what isn't kosher, and one or two other things. And right in the middle of Yoredeya, of the laws of kashrus, are the laws of interest, of money lending. What a strange place for it to be. And yet we see there are a number of reasons for that. Clearly we see from the fact that interest is in the area of Yoredeya that the law of lending without interest is not a business law. From a business perspective, it's better to lend with interest. It's better for the lender, it's better for the borrower, it's better for to be a market in debt. That's from a pure business perspective. If that weren't so, it would be forbidden altogether. The fact that it's in Yoredeya means that this is a religious law. This is like the laws of kashrus. This is not a rational law for the purposes of business. This is a religious law. This is much more of a ritualistic law. And what is the nature of that law? The Kleroko says to discourage fixed annuity income. God does not want us to have fixed monthly income. And if your business is based on lending money, you can calculate your revenue. And God doesn't like that. He likes us not to know what we're going to be getting at the end of the month. He likes to keep us insecure. In which case the Kleyaka says, well, in that case, why are you allowed to lend to non-Jews if you've got to have a non-fixed revenue and you're not allowed to lend to Jews? And here you see what Jewish business ethics is meant to be. Says the Kleyaka, because if you lend to a non-Jew, you cannot be 100% sure that you will be paid interest at the end of the month. But if you will lend to a Jew, you can know for absolute sure that that Jew would rather sell himself in slavery than miss a month's interest payment. Because that's the level of Jewish business ethics. That's what it was meant to be. That was what the Jewish reputation was meant to be. And there were times when it was like that. A bank manager in South Africa once told me that when he was being trained as a bank manager, he knew, and that was the philosophy of the bank, you could lend to any religious Jew any amount of money without security. Because it was known that come what may, that community would have it paid back on time. There was zero risk to the bank. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case. But that is what it's meant to be. So we see God not only wants us to be in business, but He doesn't want us to have secure jobs. He wants us to be in risky business. He wants us to invest equity, not debt. He wants us to participate in the risks and the benefits of business so that we remain attached to God. There is an insecurity, and that feeds our attachment to God, realizing that God is the source of our security and not our business. And so if God is the creator of business and has many reasons why He wants us involved in business, then can business access the heroic in man? Of course business can access the heroic in man. In fact, it is business more than anything that should be able to access the heroic in man. What are the conditions for that to happen? Well, General Kutuzov said part of it, I need to believe in the purpose of what I'm doing. Now let me take you through a short exercise that I sometimes do with business leaders in showing them what we really mean by believing in the purpose of what we're doing in our business. And I ask people, you can try this with yourself as we go along. I'm dealing with such an intelligent audience that I'm not going to risk trying it out on one of you because you might answer me the right way and that will make the whole thing fall flat. But you go through it in your own mind. I say to people, why do you work? I say, to earn a living. Why do you need to earn a living? Well, I've got to support myself. Well, are you working as hard as you need to support yourself or are you working harder than that? Well, it's not just me I need to support, the answer. I have a family. But interesting, you have a family. How many do you have in your family? Well, 3, 4, 5, 6 different numbers of people. I said, have you calculated what it costs to raise a child? Some of them have, some of them haven't. I don't know what it is in Canada, but in most parts of the world, it's around $1 million. Okay, to take a child from birth to post-university education is around $1 million. So I said, when you got married, did you figure out how you were going to manage $4 million? Was it realistic? No, nobody thought of it quite that way. So why then did you get married and have a family? Why did you engage in a commitment of millions of dollars that you didn't think carefully about? What was so important about getting married and having children that you were willing to put at risk millions of dollars that you didn't have? If I told you that you could employ somebody who had just done that, would you employ them? They had just taken a decision that was going to cost them millions and hadn't thought about the fact that it was going to cost. Not only didn't they know where they were going to get it from, they hadn't even made the calculation. Would you take somebody like that into your business and look at you? Well, then that gets a little bit complicated. And I say, not only why did you get married, why does anybody get married? And not only people that you know, the whole world. And it's not a recent phenomenon. It's the only institution that survived for thousands of years. So there's something about it that is so fundamental that it drives people to invest in costs of millions of dollars that they do not have because it's so important. What is so important about it? So they start, they want eternity, and I said, well, you know, take the millions of dollars. Like my son said to me the other day, instead of educating me, he said, why don't you take the money it's costing and invest it? And if you would have done that from the time I was born and not sent me to school, by the time I'm 18, I wouldn't need to go to college because I could use the money you'd be investing for me. So one has to ask that question, and why, and why, and what's the purpose? And if it's just about eternity, well, then you could take the money that you would have spent on children and you could donate a chair at a university in your name and you would have eternity that way. And all sorts of things. Eventually it comes down to, you know, it's all about love. Well, okay, now you're in business. These are now chief executives sitting around. It's got a little bit shifty now. They're talking about love all of a sudden. So they say, okay, well, what do you mean it's all about love? Millions of dollars. You're willing to pay millions of dollars for love? Couldn't you find it any other way? And then they figure, and what is it? And what does it mean exactly? We talk about a sense of soul, of being valued, a sense of value. People want to be valued. And what does value mean? Value means that somebody needs you. And the nice thing about a family is, or used to be, that it needs you. The parents need the children, the parents need each other, the children need the parents. That no matter what happens, there's a sense of, you know, in this particular area, I'm needed. In this particular area, therefore, I have value. And so we say security, in fact, comes. If we say that a human being is driven more than anything to find security, what he's driven to is to find the sense of being needed, being valued. Being valued means that I am making a contribution that is rare and that is needed. If it's not rare, then you don't need me, you can get it from somebody else. And if it's not needed, then it doesn't matter that it's rare, nobody needs it. The only time I'm going to feel like a valuable person is if my presence brings to the table something unusual that the people around me need and cannot get elsewhere. Then I will feel secure. Then I will feel valuable. And there is nothing more fundamental to the human drive than that. And then we apply it to a business. What does a business want most of all? Security. It wants to grow, it wants to be secure. What does that mean? That means the ability to provide goods or services, a contribution that is rare and that is needed. And the rarity comes from, I'll come to how we get the rarity in a moment. The what is needed comes from an innate sense of chesed, of being able to constantly tune into other people. Not only to what they think they need, but to what they really need. What about the rarity? The rarity comes, and I'll take you very briefly into the other. We've talked now about moral strategy. So my business strategy now has to become, I've got to provide something that people need and they can't get anywhere else. The more unique what I have is, and the more it is needed, the more valuable it is, the more secure my business is. When we start working out a value system for a business, one of the first things we look at is we take them through, we say, if we did universal research around the world and we asked people from all different religions and backgrounds, what is the most important starting fundamental moral principle that you've got to have before you go anywhere else? We have a bit of a discussion, and usually they come around to love your neighbor as yourself. Everybody would agree that's where it starts. And it's articulated in every religion. It starts off in the Torah, and every religion has adopted it. And then we have a little discussion about that, and we say, well, love everyone as yourself. Why not more than yourself? Why do all the religions, starting with the Torah, limit that caps the love that you're meant to feel for somebody else by the love you feel for yourself? It means you cannot love anybody more than you love yourself. We discuss why that is, and we get through that. And then we discuss, well, what is it about yourself that's worthy of love? We're talking to 100 people here, and I say, each one of you have got to love yourself. That means you've got to value yourselves. Before you can start valuing anybody else, what is there universally capable of being valued, of really loving about yourself? And again, the answer is value lies in high supply, in low supply and high demand. Therefore, value lies in the fact that there isn't another human being like me, provided I use that uniqueness to create a contribution that is unique. If I accept that there is nobody in the world like me, nor has there ever been, which is the importance in the discovery of DNA when it was first discovered as a means, or even before that, fingerprinting at the beginning of the century, discovered in England as a way of identifying murderers because of the uniqueness of the fingerprint, and then moving to DNA and the understanding that there are not two human beings who have the same DNA, that there are not two human beings who are identical, there are not two human beings who think the same, there are not two human beings who look the same, there are not two human beings who speak and articulate the same. That being the case, I am rare because I'm unique. And if what I produce comes from deep inside me, then what I produce will also be rare. And if what I produce is rare, and that depends on the value system within the organization, the morality of the organization, and what I produce is needed, and that depends on the strategic clarity of the organization, that I can innovate products and services that other people need before they even know they need them. I am so tuned into their needs that I can innovate the need. I can create needs that they didn't even used to have. And I can satisfy those needs in a way that is totally unique because I'm accessing that which is unique in my people. Then we start developing the capacity in a corporation to have people believe in the purpose of what they're doing. It's difficult to believe in it. If the focus is on getting as much as we can, difficult to believe in it. When we started off asking you, why do you work? You said, because of what I can get. I need to support my family. I need the money. But by the end of it, we were saying, I need to make a contribution that is rare and that is unique, that is rare and that is needed, so that I will be needed, so that I will be valued, so that I will be secure. But the reason I work is it's my vehicle for contributing, not my vehicle for taking. When a business makes that turnaround and begins to see itself and has its employees see it as the vehicle for facilitating each person's contribution. And money is the outcome, money is the result. It's like the scoreboard. You can't play tennis looking at the scoreboard. Play tennis looking at the ball
and the scoreboard will take care of itself. If a business focuses on the uniqueness of its contribution and the degree to which its contribution is needed, it doesn't have to worry too much about its balance sheet. It watches internal efficiencies, and its balance sheet takes care of itself. Then we can start accessing the heroic in human beings. Then we can start accessing in people that which they really believe in. I want to conclude by giving you just one or two examples of where we actually did that. The one was in a fashion company. The industry was doing very well. The industry was on a growth path. Our client was in a spiral. And they called us in and showed us that they had accessed the strategies of every one of the competitors, not only domestically but also internationally, and they had tried everything that everybody else was doing, and everything that worked for everybody else was failing for them. And they were beginning to panic. And we did some interesting work, both in strategy and in the morality of the business. And one of the things that we did there was, again, what is it that you're really supplying? Well, we're supplying clothing. Well, that's imitation. Anybody can supply clothing. There's nothing unique and rare about that. So we pushed them a little further. Well, they're supplying fashion. Well, what does fashion mean? At the end of the day, we got them a little bit embarrassed when I said, well, what fashion means is you're supplying them clothes that cost more than they ought to cost, and you're calling it fashion. And you're asking your people to believe in that and to do the heroic. You're trying to access the heroic by getting people to sell things at multiples of its value because you're calling it fashion. And they're shifting in their seats. And I said, no wonder you're in a spiral. So well, what must we do? Drop our prices? No. Raise your prices. Well, what's that going to help? Well, you'll be able to raise your prices if you really understand the uniqueness of what you're selling. So we started probing. Why do people buy fashion? Why do the stupid buyers, why do the stupid customers pay more? They realize that they're paying more for fashion. What drives people to buy fashion? Question we can all ask ourselves. What drives us to buy fashion? And after probing, we came to the conclusion it was the desire to be enthused with confidence. That's what fashion does. It creates in a person. If you see in a person walking who's fashionably dressed, it's not just they're dressed fashionably because they're confident. There is an enthusiastic confidence that comes with knowing that you're dressed just right. That's what you're selling. Because for enthusiastic confidence, people will pay a lot. They'll pay therapists and they don't even go out with a suit of clothes. They go out with nothing. Just with the belief that they feel a little bit more enthusiastic, a little bit more confident. But you're giving them enthusiasm and confidence and you're giving them the clothes for nothing. That's a good deal. You're charging less than the therapist and they're getting a suit of clothes. Well, when we were able to understand that, we began to change the entire organization. The music that was played in the stores, the way the salespeople were dressed, the way the change rooms were fitted out, the way the merchandise was bought and presented. Everything was changed with the realization that we're not selling fashion, we're not selling clothes, we're selling the feeling of being enthused with confidence. And thank goodness that company has never looked back. It has seen through a number of downturns in the industry. It has never been in a downturn. It had a crisis which was not of its own making. It sailed through the crisis. It has its entire body of employees incredibly committed and hardworking. It's accessing the heroic in its people. There was a lot of work this organization did, but these were the lines along which it did it, to create a unique and needed contribution and then to build a value system internally that supported that value system. And the last example was a company that you all know very well, and that was Coca-Cola. And one of the things we did with one of their sections overseas, not in this continent, was a similar exercise where we got people then to understand that they were doing the same, of course. They're charging a lot of money for water and a bit of sugar and a little bit of other things. And there was no way of justifying that kind of cost. In fact, when they spoke to us to help them manage the morale during downsizing. It was a recession. It was the downsizing trend, you'll remember, the re-engineering. And for the first time, Pepsi-Cola was entering their market. So they projected the market downturn, they projected the reduction in sales, They knew how many people they would have to lay off, and they presented over a two-hour presentation to me exactly what their plan was and how they were going to do it and how many people would be affected. And they asked me what we could do to help. And I said, well, it depended. I wasn't interested in managing the morale during the downturn, if that's what they wanted us to do. There are other consultants who can do that better. But if they were interested in not closing down any plants, in keeping everybody they had got, and increasing their market share by at least 15% a year over the next 3 years, then I would be interested in talking to them. And they said, you don't understand, let us explain again. And so this discussion went on. And that's exactly what we did. Pepsi-Cola was driven out of the market, they dominated the market, they expanded, they grew, nobody lost their jobs, they hired more people, they were takeovers, it was unbelievable growth. And one of the differences we did is we shifted them from selling Coca-Cola to selling fun and refreshment. Now that's quite easy. What was hard was to get every employee to change their mindset. Because now you're in the entertainment business, you're no longer in the drinks business. And your client, you're not dealing with the end consumer, the Coca-Cola bottler deals with the retailer. And the need to be able to enthuse fun and entertainment and refreshment in those interactions required accessing a part of the employee that had never been accessed before. But who do you think feels better about his work? A worker who feels exploited selling water at 1,000 times the price of water with some sugar added, or somebody who sees himself as a purveyor of refreshment and fun? Who do you think feels greater about his work? Somebody who's selling clothing at 10 times the price of the clothing, or somebody who's enthusing customers with confidence and with a sense of being? Not easy to turn the company around, but incredibly gratifying. When you've got an employee body focused on growth, on moral growth, on ethical growth, on worthwhile growth, tuned into the customer, tuned into uniqueness, tuned into a value system that is essential for the growth of the organization, then we have a group of Rosh Hashivas rather than a group of Mashkichim. The debate and the discussion is how can we do more right, not how can we stop doing wrong. And of course, you do need people watching out for the wrong. It happens, and you need people all the time keeping a careful eye. But for the growth of the business, it's so important for people to be watching for the mitzvahs aseh, the positive mitzvahs, not only the negative mitzvahs. And when business ethics is identified with growth and with dynamics and with expansion rather than with contraction, when we do every now and again say, oh, this is not okay, this we shouldn't be doing, companies are very quick to say, sure, then let's stop. And that changes the focus a little bit. We'll try to give you some inkling of a different aspect, of a different angle to where morality comes into business and to the understanding that when I started my business, I started it as a non-profit organization, and suddenly I realized, hey, if my thesis is right, they should be willing to pay me more than any other consultant. This shouldn't be non-profit. That undermines the thesis. If I believe God created business and I'm bringing the Torah to business, why should this be non-profit? Why should I be reliant on donations? And so I closed the non-profit, turned it into profit, made the rates higher than any consultant to test God. That was all. And thank God he passed the test.
Thank you very much for that very interesting and unique, enlightening type of a perspective. I'm not sure what I should call it, a speech, or can we have to think of another name for a shiur is whatever. Okay, we're not going to take a break now. What we're going to do is we're going to have our case study, which I know you don't have. Each one of these people here are going to speak just a few minutes. And the purpose is to generate a discussion. This one will take all your questions, etc., on a particular case, and then you can ask the other questions you have before, and that's how we'll do it. So I'm going to ask Ash, I'll ask Mark. Mark, don't you? Yeah, okay.